It is Monday, November the 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, the U.S. reimposing sanctions on Iran.
The restoration of these sanctions includes penalties on Iran's banking sector, as well as on shipping, insurance, shipbuilding, what have you.
Thousands of potential asylum seekers headed to the U.S.
There is a right to claim asylum. It is not illegal, as the president has claimed, to claim asylum at the border. Migrants aren't obligated to claim asylum in any country. They have a right to seek asylum in a country of their choosing.
Some say an election like no other in a generation is coming to the U.S., plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Iran's supreme leader is declaring victory over the United States after nearly 40 years of confrontation. That story from AP's Ben Thomas.
The U.S. is the defeated side, and the Islamic Republic is the victorious party. That's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's assessment of the confrontations between Iran and the U.S. since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He says the U.S. no longer dominates Iran the way it did under the pro-Western monarchy that ruled prior to 1979. The comments come a day after the Trump administration announced it would reinstate sanctions effective Monday, and on the eve of the anniversary of the 1979 takeover of the U.S. embassy in Tehran. Ben Thomas, Washington.
The Trump administration is restoring sanctions targeting Iran's shipping as well as financial and energy sectors, but carved out exemptions for eight countries which can still import oil from Iran without penalty. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who largely has been the White House point person on Iran, appeared on Fox News Sunday.
I am very confident that the sanctions that will be reimposed this Monday, not only the crude oil sanctions, but the financial sanctions that are being put in place by the Treasury Department and over 600 designations of individuals and companies in Iran, will have the intended effect to alter the Iranian regime's behavior. That's our expectation. It's the reason for President Trump's policy.
VOA's Victor Beatty asked Benham Bentaleblou, a research fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, for his thoughts on all of this.
With respect to the commemoration of the hostage crisis, that's a national holiday in the Islamic Republic, and elites celebrate that. And over the years, the pageantry from the populace has actually waxed and waned over time as the anti-Americanism of the regime stayed the same and that of the population declined. Of course, this year that takes on a new color because of the restoration of the heavy Iran nuclear deal-related sanctions. So the regime obviously wanted to make a very strong showing and likely either coerced or compelled or incentivized people as well as some of its social base to turn out because they needed to present such optics at a time when Iran looks divided and at a time when there is increasing international pressure on the regime by way of these coercive economic penalties. The second is, of course, getting into those coercive economic penalties. Some of the strongest sanctions that the U.S. has ever devised or levied on Iran, particularly the oil sanctions, the restoration of these sanctions includes penalties on Iran's banking sector, those who provide financial messaging services to the regime, as well as on shipping, insurance, shipbuilding, what have you. I think the secretary is correct. These are very powerful sanctions. A waiver may not have the best political optics, but you want to be able to reduce purchases of Iranian crude and condensate as wisely as possible. So you do want to ultimately drive them to zero or as close to zero as possible, but you want to do it in a way that doesn't spike oil prices, that doesn't harm markets. And I think this way seems to be the best way possible.
This is designed for maximum pressure on the Iranian economy. What is the purpose of the sanctions?
Well, the purpose of the sanctions and the overall course of Iran policy is to get the Islamic Republic back to the negotiating table. And we know that in the past, it was literally these same sets of sanctions that brought Tehran to the table to talk in 2012, 2013. But now they're doing it with more designated entities and with more risk aversion by banks and businesses because they know the kind of illicit financial conduct that these financial institutions in Iran underwrite. The goal is not just a nuclear deal. It's not just revising the JCPOA. It's to get a comprehensive agreement on all the threats that the Islamic Republic poses. And in May 2018, Secretary Pompeo elaborated them in the form of 12 demands.
As you know, a lot of these U.S. sanctions are hitting European companies quite hard. Obviously, they are the secondary casualties in this situation.
Well, in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. You've seen this large exodus of foreign firms from Iran after May 8th. That's the day the U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA nuclear deal. You saw the exodus because a lot of those foreign firms, banks, businesses had ties to the U.S., used the U.S.-led financial system, used the U.S. dollar, transacted in dollars, had entities or affiliates that were based in the U.S. or, you know, had U.S. persons on their board. So they needed to insulate themselves from U.S. financial pressure. And the best way to do that was to make a decision both in line with their bottom line and a decision in line with the business environment in Tehran. And both of them said, disconnect from Iran and stick to the U.S. So that's why you had this large exodus of firms. But when it comes to the other side of the coin, the European and Asian banks and businesses that may choose to stay, they will face the secondary sanctions. Those are some of the most powerful sanctions the U.S. has. Those are penalties designed not to go after the target state, but to put economic partner of the target state to a choice. Stay with the U.S. or stay with Iran. You can't have both.
The French press agency tried to put a human face on these sanctions. A 70-year-old Iranian who's been selling industrial equipment from his small store in a Tehran bazaar since before the revolution. First time says he's not sure he can survive. He says, literally, my shelves are empty, my warehouses are empty, and soon I will have to close the doors. This has been my entire life. I won't survive long after the doors close. Are these sanctions having that kind of effect?
I'm not sure it's the sanctions that are actually driving these smaller private entities and genuine private businesses in Iran out. In fact, one of the greatest forces that has been diminishing the legitimate private sector in Iran has been the multiple banks, businesses, and affiliates of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps that have squeezed the Tehran Bazaar over time, even though the Tehran Bazaar was actually one of the key social and economic forces that helped bring about the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Obviously, the sanctions are powerful tools. They're macroeconomic tools, but they're tools designed to put the regime to a choice and to get the regime to abandon its policies that are destabilizing abroad and that are suppressive at home.
Will these sanctions change Iranian behavior?
That's ultimately the goal. The goal is to compel Iran to think twice. Every dollar it spends, every rial it spends supporting Lebanese Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Assad, Shiite militias, the Houthis in Yemen, or the other Shiite militants in Bahrain or the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, is a dollar or a rial taken away from their population, taken away when they need it most. Once the squeeze comes, Tehran will be forced to choose.
Iran insists that it can circumvent these sanctions and sell oil by other means.
You know, that is actually what happened for parts of the previous sanctions regime in 2012. There's this famous sanctions buster. We all know him now. He's behind bars in Iran, Bob Rafsanjani. He basically helped acquire shares of a bank in Malaysia. So when Iran's banks were taken off the SWIFT financial network, this bank that was Iranian owner-controlled was able to engage in transactions for the sale of Iranian illicit oil through Labuan, Malaysia. So Iran has these creative schemes before. Obviously, tanker tracking technology has changed. Obviously, banks and businesses are much more risk-averse. People are actually engaged in due diligence. Know your customer's customer is an important part of engaging in transactions with jurisdictions of weak central authority or jurisdictions where there's a military and business and in politics, as is the case with Iran. Ultimately, it'll be up to the jurisdictions that are using the UN Security Council Resolution 2231 that still makes it legal to transact with Iran as a shield against Western sanctions. These are countries like Turkey, Georgia, other areas where Iranians like to go shopping and have set up businesses. We obviously have to keep our eyes on that. We have to keep our eyes on the humanitarian channel that Iran has abused before and that the Treasury Department has warned about. But I'm confident that the U.S. sanctions can help put Tehran to that choice.
Benham Bentelebou is a research fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. The International Organization for Migration says the Central American migration caravan winding its way through Mexico toward the United States is an annual event and poses no threat to anyone. Lisa Schlein reporting now from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
U.S. President Donald Trump calls the migrant caravan moving toward the United States' southern border an invasion, a view the International Organization for Migration does not share. IOM spokesman Joel Millman tells VOA the caravan is not an emergency.
The next point I would make is that they're nowhere near the border yet, so it's a little bit difficult to respond to hypotheticals, you know, is it an invasion? And they're hundreds of miles away. I've never heard generally anyone thinking this is a threat to civil peace in these annual events.
Among the thousands of migrants from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador are asylum seekers fleeing persecution and violence. Under international law, countries are obliged to grant them access to their territory and give them international protection. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And for some perspective on all of this, VOA's Laurie London speaks with Zoe Robinson, a scholar at Australian National University in the School of Politics and International Relations.
There is a right to claim asylum. It is not illegal, as the president has claimed, to claim asylum at the border. Migrants aren't obligated to claim asylum in any country. They have a right to seek asylum in a country of their choosing, a right to fair process, and a right to be not sent back to a country where they're going to face persecution or death.
Okay.
So that is pretty clear in terms of international law. There is a right to claim asylum. It is not illegal to do so. And it is an international obligation on the country that has signed up to the Refugee Convention to accept and hear the claims of those migrants.
But do countries have a right to just say, no, we're not even, we're, no, you can't come in?
No, you can't come in. Well, I mean, we're a legal framework, the legal framework under which the U.S. operates is the 1951 Convention on the Status of Refugees, right? It developed at the end of World War II. It developed categories on which asylum claims can be based. U.S. is a signatory to that convention, and there are any country that's party to the Refugee Convention has an obligation under international law to follow the terms of those conventions.
My question would be just in general, the use of military troops to contain asylum seekers. This seems unusual in a democratic society. Has this been done elsewhere?
Not that I'm aware of. The holding off asylum seekers from crossing the border into the country that is a signatory to the Refugee Convention is, as far as I'm aware of, fairly unique. Now, of course, that's not to say that doesn't exist and hasn't happened elsewhere. It could have done. My specialty is U.S. and Australian politics. So beyond that, I couldn't comment.
Okay.
But it does seem to be a fairly unique situation where he is used to try to hold off asylum seekers from entering the country and being able to make an asylum claim at all.
And then we've got this other very big issue that the president just sort of put out there recently that sounds very controversial. And he basically said he was going to try to end the constitutionally protected right of birthright citizenship for all children born in the United States. That is part of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
But he seems to feel he can just sign an executive order and change the Constitution. What do you know about this? Is this possible?
No, it's not possible. The president seems to feel he can do a lot of things these days. Certainly changing the Constitution unilaterally with an executive order is not one of those things that is constitutional. We have a very clear amendment process, and in order to change the 14th Amendment Birthright Citizenship Clause, he would need to go through a full amendment of the Constitution, which is extremely difficult. Only very few amendments have passed since the birth of the Constitution. So, as you're probably aware, 14th Amendment was imposed or was enacted after the Civil War. It was there to overturn Justice Taney's Dred Scott decision saying that slaves were not citizens of the United States. The portion was there put that any person born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States. Now, those terms are very clear. These cases have been, the terms have been tested before the Supreme Court. There was a 1898 case called United States v. Wong Kim Ark. The question there was whether the amendment applied to the children of non-citizens. And so the petitioner there was born to Chinese immigrants in San Francisco. At that time, Chinese people had been barred from entering the U.S. by the Chinese Exclusion Act. And the court said plainly that citizenship by birth is established by the mere fact of birth under the circumstances defined in the Constitution.
Zoe Robinson is a scholar at Australian National University in the School of Politics and International Relations. She was speaking with VOA's Laurie London.
She said she too young, don't want no man.
Starting Monday, November 5th, tune into Border Crossings to win a free copy of Now 68, featuring top songs from a variety of artists. This CD features Calvin Harris's One Kiss,
falling in love with me,
along with Ariana Grande's God is a Woman, and many other hit songs. Tune in to Border Crossings to win.
U.S. voters have a chance to change the Congress here in the United States on Tuesday. It'll be the midterm elections that could have a significant impact on the balance of power here in Washington and on the next 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has a preview of the election.
At stake on Tuesday are all 435 seats in the House of Representatives, 35 of the 100 U.S. Senate seats, and 36 state governor's races. In the final days of the campaign, President Donald Trump is trying to boost Republican turnout with a focus on immigration.
Republicans want strong borders, no crime, no chaos, and no caravans. Democrats want open borders, and they want to invite caravan after caravan into our country, which brings crime upon crime.
Democrats are focused on health care and Trump's governing style and are counting on a strong voter turnout with help from top Democrats like former President Barack Obama.
You can choose a bigger, more hopeful, more generous vision of America. But to do it, you got to vote.
Democrats expect to make gains on Tuesday, according to Brookings Institution analyst John Hudak.
Right now, it does look like Democrats will do quite well in House races, probably enough to take back majority control of the House. And the Senate will remain quite divided, likely in Republican hands.
And President Trump figures to be a top issue for voters in both parties, says American University expert Alan Lichtman.
I think this is the most nationalized election in modern memory. It was a recent poll which said that two-thirds of Americans believe that Donald Trump will be a major or a minor factor in their voting. Two-thirds.
Trump is also running against history, says analyst Kyle Kondik.
Again, the midterm history is pretty stark in that the president's party usually loses ground in the midterm. It's just a question, usually a question of how much ground they lose. That's particularly true when a president is unpopular, as this president is.
If Democrats are able to win back control of the House, it could alter the next 2 years of the Trump presidency. John Fortier is with the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington.
It looks a lot different if there's divided government and Democrats have part of the levers of power. They won't be there to pass Trump legislation, but more importantly, they'll be there to really raise a louder voice against Donald Trump through investigations and their opportunity to really put another viewpoint forward.
Republicans remain slight favorites to maintain their narrow 51 to 49 seat edge in the U.S. Senate. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of soul superstar Freddie Scott. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA has concluded that the 11-year mission of the Dawn spacecraft and its exploration of Vesta and Ceres, two of the largest objects in the asteroid belt, has come to an end. According to the space agency, the spacecraft missed scheduled communication sessions with NASA's Deep Space Network not only on October 31st, but also on November 1st. NASA says the Dawn flight team checked through a number of possible causes for that lack of contact, but the mission's managers realized that the spacecraft simply ran out of its hydrazine fuel. That fuel supply allowed mission specialists to control the spacecraft's pointing. Without this ability, Dawn was no longer able to set its antennas to communicate with its controllers on Earth, nor could it turn and adjust its solar panels to get a power recharge from the sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Guess what? Time now for a little something from the world of music. Scott was an American soul singer and songwriter. Among his biggest hits was Are You Lonely for Me, Baby, a top 10 U.S. pop hit in 1963, and a number one hit on the R&B chart. Come on and try to forget all the pain I brought you. Go on and Freddie Scott was born in 1933 in Providence, Rhode Island, and sang in his grandmother's gospel group. They toured England when he was just 12 years old. He studied medicine at the University of Rhode Island and then at Payne College in Augusta, Georgia, but began singing again with the Swanee Quintet Juniors and gave up his medical career. Among his fans' many favorites is "You Got What I Need."
Oh, baby, you got what I need. You got everything I need. You're like medicine to me, oh, baby. In a world of salted tears, so afraid and full of fears, so glad you saved me, dear. Going down for the third time, you came and saved me, dear.
Saved me, dear.
All the sweet things you've been doing, I ain't never been used to them. Don't ever stop them, dear.
Stop them, dear.
Oh, I'm thankful every day,
ooh,
all that you came away.
Ooh,
and I'm gonna make sure,
ooh,
that you know.
In the 1950s, Scott was called up to serve in the U.S. military in the Koreas, but continued to record for small labels with little success. After leaving the military, he turned to songwriting at the famed Brill Building in New York City, where he recorded many of his own demos and also recorded "I'll Be Gone."
Child, I talked like a child, I acted like a child. Now I'm a man, I'm through with my childish ways. And baby, I've got news for you. I'm telling you what you gotta do. You gotta hold me. You gotta love me. You gotta squeeze me. Or I'll be gone. Ha! Like a child, stayed like a child, obeyed like a child. Now I'm a man, I put away my childish ways. You see, I'll leave my shell like a butterfly. I'll spread my wings and take to the sky. I'll be leaving. I'll be leaving. I'll feel a freedom. Cause I'll be gone.
In 1962, Freddie Scott worked with fellow songwriters Gary Goffin and Carole King on their song, "Hey Girl." He recorded that song, which went to number 10 on both the pop and R&B charts.
Hey girl, I want you to know I'm gonna miss you so much if you go.
Bye, baby.
And hey, girl, I tell you no lie. Something deep inside of me's going to die. If you say so.
Nearing the end of his career, Freddie Scott worked on the oldies circuit and released a new album in 2001. Sadly, he died in New York City in 2007. He was 74.
Hey girl, this can't be true. How am I supposed to exist without you? Hey girl, now don't put me on. What's gonna happen to me when you're gone?
I had the privilege, and I must say the privilege, to hear him sing that a cappella to a lot of beautiful women in the TV studio where I worked in Houston years ago. Great, great, great guy. Amazing, Freddie Scott. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America, International Editions, the program. Good to have you here. Up next, the latest world news, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington hoping you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Freddie Scott.
Hey, girl, now sit yourself down. The same to get down on the ground and beg you to stay.
This is Today in History. On November 5th, 1566, the armies of the Mughal Empire and the forces of the King of Afghanistan fought at the Second Battle of Panipat. The Mughal victory ensured the reign of Akbar the Great, extending his empire's control over most of the Indian subcontinent. On this day in 1605, a plot to blow up the British Parliament building was thwarted by the arrest of Roman Catholic militant Guy Fawkes. Fawkes had planned to set off a gunpowder explosion in the basement of the building during an address by Protestant King James I. He hoped James would be succeeded by his Catholic daughter. Fawkes and his co-conspirators were tried, convicted, and executed. In commemoration of the event, Guy Fawkes Day is observed as a holiday in Britain each November 5th. In 1930, American author Sinclair Lewis was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, the first American to ever win the honor. He established his literary reputation with works such as Babbitt, Main Street, Aerosmith, and Elmer Gantry. In 1912, Democratic Party nominee Woodrow Wilson was elected the 28th President of the United States, the only time in history when both the incumbent, in this case William Howard Taft, and a former president, Theodore Roosevelt, were defeated at the polls. In 1935, the Parker Brothers Company began its first major effort to market the popular board game Monopoly. In 1940, Democrat Franklin D. Roosevelt was elected to an unprecedented third term in office. In 2007, China's first lunar satellite went into orbit around the moon. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.